For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way toward salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. In the cave with me, Mr. Mark Tuttle, Mr. Timothy O'Donnell. Guys, I'm showing my age today. I am old enough to remember the Latin Mass.
Oh.
And then came Vatican II.
Yeah.
And the Latin Mass disappeared. And then gradually over the years, it's come back. And now within just the past few months, there's become a new controversy over the Latin Mass. So we need to take a look at the history of the Mass, the Latin Mass, and what's going on. And in order to make that happen, I think we need help.
We sure do.
Yeah, that's a little above my pay grade, dude.
Mine, too. We need to, Mark, we need, well, it's our good friend, Dr. David Deevil. He's the assistant professor of Catholic Studies at the University of St. Thomas. He's been with us many times in the past. He's talked about areas that he's so good in, which is John Henry Newman, G.K. Chesterton, anything associated with literature and Solzhenitsyn. Okay, and I know we got a lot to talk about what you've been up to, Dr. Deevil, but we want to jump in and talk a little bit about the Latin Mass. Like, what is it? Where does it come from? There's a lot of terminology to get to. So welcome.
Thank you, gentlemen. Glad to be with you again.
Yes, you are. You're a fellow cave dweller. So you may be a Batman, but you are a fellow...
Bats are in caves. That's exactly where I was going there. Although the Robin thing fell apart on me pretty fast.
But yeah, you are a you are an honorary caveman at this point.
That's right. I'm a spelunker.
Excellent. There we go. He comes in. He looks around. He sees us, and he leaves.
Right.
All right.
Well, the Latin Mass, yes, this is a great topic. Pope Francis released this motu proprio called Traditionis Custodes, the custodians of tradition, about 2 or 3 months ago, and it set new rules about which priests can do the Latin Mass. And as you said, we probably ought to talk a little bit about the history of that. What we're talking about is, of course, the Roman Rite, the liturgy that came out of Rome and that is the rite, for the most part, of most Catholics throughout the world. There are a number of other rites that are out there, mostly Eastern rites today. If you've ever been to a Ukrainian Byzantine church or Ruthenian, or perhaps the Maronites who originate in Lebanon and the Middle East, there are different forms of the Mass or the Divine Liturgy. The Roman Rite is, of course, the biggest one, and it was the one that spread because of the Pope's influence. And a lot of people say, well, this is something that just came about during the Council of Trent about 400 years ago. But the reality is that the essence of the Roman Rite was there pretty early. Many liturgical historians think it's probably one of the earlier forms of the Mass to come into place, and its essentials are there. Now, it started off not as the Latin Mass, but in the Church of Rome, they said it in Greek for the first few centuries. But starting at about the 4th or 5th century, it was in Latin, and it had a number of pieces. And that developed over time. We didn't always have the creed in the Mass. That didn't come about in the Roman Mass until probably the 8th or 9th centuries. It started off, they started putting it in liturgies in Spain in about the 5th or 6th century. So there were changes, but largely the parts were there, and it was an organic development over time. At the Council of Trent in the 16th century, they didn't create a new Mass. What they did was they sort of said, okay, this is the form of it that we're going to go with. And that form, generally speaking, was kept over the next 4 centuries. And it was, largely speaking, in Latin, although there were, interestingly enough, exceptions. In certain places, there was permission given to do it in other languages. And so, you know, in one part of the Central Europe, they had something called Glottolitic Slavonic, a form of that liturgical language that that was used by Saints Cyril and Methodius, the one that they came up with. So there were exceptions to the language thing, but largely speaking, the parts were the same. At Vatican II, there was a call to do a few things to sort of trim some things up, and there was an initial change in the Mass that resulted in something called the 1965 Missal, which was largely the same. It had a few trimmings, but there was a push to be even more radical, and then what we got was the 1970 Missal, which changed a number of things. It added new Eucharistic prayers. It added the prayers of the faithful. It was not demanded that it was done in English or the tongue of the people, but many people interpret it that way. It was not demanded that the priest face the people from the other side of the altar all the time, but many people interpreted it that way. And that form has been what we've had for the last 50 years. But a lot of people have said that they think the older form is actually more beautiful and more full. An English scholar named Matthew Hazel has recently done a study of the prayers, and he says, you know, effectively about 87% of the prayers of the old rite were lost. A lot of those were the propers, the prayers for the particular feast days. And so many people over the years have become much more attracted to the older form of the Mass. About 10 years ago, Pope Benedict XVI released his own motu proprio called Summorum Pontificum, of the highest pontiff. It was a declaration that priests would be free to say the old rite or the Mass, what he called the extraordinary form of the Roman rite, basically at their own volition. And so during that last 10 years, a lot of people have been attracted to it, and a lot of priests have been attracted to it, and it began to grow. And so it was that there were people who were very upset about that. They said, well, this is going backwards. And so many of them were working, they work in the Vatican and in various chancery offices, and they said, we want to pare this back. And so they were able to convince Pope Francis to release his motu proprio, which now said that bishops have the right to tell you, you can't say it even on your own, and any new priest who wants to say this older form of the Mass has to get permission from Rome, a number of these other things. So this has really kicked up a storm, because the growth in the number of people who are interested in the old Mass has been kind of extraordinary, and it's included some pretty well-known Catholics in the sort of the media entertainment world, people like Michael Knowles, who many people know from Ben Shapiro's Daily, a big Latin Mass goer, and of course Scott Hahn, the great Catholic convert and biblical scholar, is also an attendee of the Latin Mass. A number of people have been like this. So this motu proprio, paring it back and saying the bishops can kind of squash it in various ways, has been received with a lot of controversy. And I wrote a piece called Pope Francis and the Latin Mass, A Mistake, and it's now included in a volume of responses to the motu proprio that's being published by Angelico Press. It's called From Benedict's Peace to Francis's War, and it's edited by Peter Kwasniewski, who is a theologian and composer and liturgical scholar. And so that's where the controversy is, and that's my sort of summary of the history.
Well, thank you for that. That was a
fantastic. Outstanding.
Yeah, that was a fantastic.
Let's pause and replay that, Mark.
You know, my initial thoughts go a lot of different places, but the first question is this status of having two forms of the Roman rite. You know, that seems pretty, I guess, extraordinary, to use a it's not really a pun, but no joke intended there. What's the status of having two forms of the same rite? That seems very strange and very odd.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is in one sense that you would have sort of two forms of the Roman rite itself. But in another way, it's not completely foreign, because over time, there were a number of other rites that were almost like the Roman rite, but slightly different, usually done by different religious orders. So there's what's known as the Dominican rite. And excuse me, it's essentially the same form of the Roman rite, but it's as it developed over time in the Dominican order. Another thing that Pope Benedict did was he instituted the Ordinariate of St. Peter, which was a legal structure for people coming out of the Church of England, the Anglican, or in the U.S., the Episcopal Church, who wanted communion with Rome, and they wanted to retain some of the traditions they had. And so they have a Book of Divine Worship that has a kind of version of the liturgy that is connected to the old English Anglican liturgy, but nevertheless has been made more in continuity with the Roman rite. So it's an oddity in one sense, but it's not an oddity in another. There's always been a certain amount of diversity in the Western rites and indeed the Roman rite. Now, a lot of people said, well, to have two forms of the Roman rite per se, that both go by that name, is a little bit odd. And I think, this is where I think people who think of themselves as traditional and people who think of themselves as progressive agree. And so the difference is the progressives say, we want to get rid of any trace of the old Mass. What was done in 1970 is now the thing. Forget the old stuff. And many of the people who would consider themselves traditionalists say, this new Mass, it was a nice try, but you know what, let's just go back. If it's not broke, don't fix it. Or I suppose, since we're talking about the 16th century, if it's not Baroque, don't fix it either. So.
Well, you know, that's a fascinating, tracing out of the history of the Mass and the different forms. I know it's been... there's a lot of confusion out there. I mean, I just think one thing I'll respond to quickly is it just strikes me as odd for a Catholic to take a position of, hey, let's just kind of dispense or dispose of old stuff. I mean, we love our tradition and the fact that we take a lot of pride that the Catholic Church is 2,000 years old. So that to me is kind of odd that you throw stuff away. But I think one of the... Part of one of the confusions that's out there, there's a lot of misunderstandings. So, for example, I've been introducing, I love going to the traditional Latin Mass, and there's not one immediately available to us, so we have to make the hour plus drive to do it. But we do it from time to time. So, as I've introduced my wife to it, one of the things that she shared with me that was kind of eye opening is, we're of the age of I barely remember the Latin Mass because I was born in 1965. So all of that really changed, as I was making my first Holy Communion and things like that. So, and same with her. So she thought that the Novus Ordo Mass was the traditional Latin Mass, with the only difference being that it's in English instead of Latin. And she had no idea that, as you just mentioned, that, so much actually changed, and that I think that's a very respectful way to put it, the kind of trimming that has happened. But yeah, 87% of the traditional Latin Mass didn't, in one way, shape, didn't really make it in whole into the new Mass. And that's been pretty, that's probably a wider held misunderstanding among a lot of the laity.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of people think, well, it's just the only difference is it's in Latin. But you can do the Novus Ordo, or the New Order Mass, as many people call it, in Latin. And you can do it with at least some of the things that went with the old Mass. You can do it in chant. You can do it ad orientem, or that's where the priest is facing the same direction as the people when he's making the sacrifice, and only turning when he addresses the people. And you can do it with older vestments that were more common, the priestly garb. But the difference is, as you pointed out, there are a lot of prayers that are missing. There are a lot of gestures that are missing. Pope Benedict's Summorum Pontificum, in sort of freeing the old rite, as it were, he said that he wants a kind of mutual aid society in which things that were good about the new Mass, we might say that the prayers of the are good, or some people might say, you know, not everybody will agree with this, but they'll say, well, reading the having a reading from the Old Testament is a good thing, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
His idea was that eventually, you know, the good parts of both would kind of affect each other, and maybe we could go forth and, you know, as Mark said, you know, maybe it's an odd thing to have two forms. Maybe at some point we can have a kind of meet in the... I think that that would be a desirable thing, but I think those who are pushing to get rid of the old Mass entirely are in some ways guaranteeing that people then have to sort of make a choice. And the problem is that, you know, it's a small number, but it's a growing number of people who say, well, I really like all that stuff that was missing, you know, from the new Mass.
Right, right.
And so I'd rather go to the old Mass because there's so much there. So it's... you know, this is something that I think people discover. When I came into the church, so I grew up as a Protestant, and I came in to the church at about the age of 23, and one of the first parishes that I belonged to, it was just down the street from where I was living, and I thought, this is great, you know, it's a new Catholic. And well, it turned out to be the charismatic parish, and I wasn't terribly charismatic as a Protestant. And I thought, you know, it wasn't exactly my cup of tea, but I joined a small group, and a lot of the people who were in the parish were not necessarily charismatic themselves. And so a couple of guys said, oh, well, you ought to go with us. So we went to a parish. This was in Grand Rapids, Michigan, on the east side of town, where every Sunday night they did the new form, the Novus Ordo Mass, but they did it in Latin with chant and the propers and all of that sort of thing. And I loved that. At the same time, a priest friend said, you know, I help out at the Ukrainian Byzantine Church. We do the Liturgy of St. John Chrysostom. Come at. And so I would often on Sundays go to a Ukrainian Mass and then go to the Latin Mass in the newer form. And to me, those two shared much more than many of the sort of the modern ways in which people did the Mass, which seemed to me Protestantized in a kind of a bad way. But I think that people are going to choose. They love tradition. You know, you choose the church because of its long heritage and not because it's sort of, you know, it's got the newest TikTok videos or something like that.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, we need to, what? Kent's giving me a signal?
Yeah.
It must be time for a...
We need to take a break.
Okay.
And we're going to be back with more with Dr. David Deevil right after this. You're listening to The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy.
You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy, converting the culture to Christ through radio, featuring 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Do your friends a favor. Tell them about Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to The Catholic Cave. In the cave is Mark Tuttle, myself, Timothy O'Donnell, our trusty sidekick, Kent Blanford, and our good friend and guest, Dr. David Deevil. You remember him. He's the assistant professor of Catholic studies up there at the University of St. Thomas Aquinas. You're also the editor of a wonderful Catholic publication that I subscribe to called Logos Magazine. It's fantastic. Great articles. Highly recommend our listeners not only just check it out, but go ahead and subscribe. Or you know what else is nice? Christmas is coming, Mark, and my subscription's coming up. I think you might consider renewing my subscription.
Aha, subscriptions fit very nicely in stockings.
Yes, they do. Thank you. Well, we were talking about and have been talking about, I want to talk some more about the traditional Latin Mass. One of the things that has come up, Dr. Deevil, I think is... We throw around terms. I know I'm guilty of doing this. Sometimes when we have we're talking about the two different forms of the Mass, the ordinary form, extraordinary form. Under the extraordinary form, that's the one we tends to be referred to as the Latin Mass because it's said in Latin. or sometimes it's referred to as the traditional Latin Mass. I had my pastor actually caught me off guard, and he was like, TLM, TLM, TLM. I'm like, oh, wait, what are you talking about? And he's like, okay, that's traditional Latin Mass too. Another name for it is the Tridentine Mass, which comes from the Council of Trent, because that, as you mentioned, that sort of
where it was standardized.
Yeah, standardized, yeah. Kind of a decree, like going forward, this is the way things are going to be. That kind of brings me to a point. So, how should we as Catholics understand or reconcile? It seems like coming out of the Council of Trent, you've got the form of that. There's an effort there, a decree to standardize in perpetuity the form of the Mass. But then in 1970, it seems like there's a pretty substantial, there's not just like a, should we understand it's kind of more of a development? Is it more of a break? How do we put those two pieces together when you've got one decree in place for 400 years? Now it feels like something, it's even called the new Mass. So something new has happened. How should Catholics understand that?
Yeah, it's a good question, because a lot of people read this document. I believe it's called Quo Primum by Pope Pius V, and he basically said that, you know, this should be the Mass in perpetuity. Now, you can read that as a kind of, that the Mass, you know, this is the form that the Mass will take forever. I think that's not a good reading, but what he did say was that, you know, we have tried to lock down at least the basic form of the Mass. And one of the things that happened with this is that all Masses that could not trace their lineage more than 200 years at that time were suppressed. So what they didn't want was people sort of, you know, riffing, you know, in the 16th century off the Mass and coming up with their own new forms. Now, that might have been a little bit too much. Klaus Gomber, who was a German liturgical scholar, Pope Benedict wrote an introduction to one of his books on the reform of the Roman liturgy. Monsignor Gomber thought that there was a problem in that perhaps at Trent they were a little too zealous to keep things in, sort of cut off forms of organic development by which, you know, things change a little bit at a time. There's time to see whether this is something that's of the Lord or of just simply the spirit of the age. And so he thought that maybe there was a problem there, that there was a cutoff of organic development, and of course this built up, and then in the 1960s, the 1960s, everywhere was crazy, and so people kind of went bananas. So there's a real question about how that goes, because everybody knows that the liturgy does develop over time. You know, I brought up that originally the Latin Mass was in Greek. You know, originally it didn't have the creed. There are additions. So the question is, how do you get that kind of true organic development that allows the church to have time to process it? As I said, Pope Benedict XVI, with freeing the Latin Mass, I think wanted to sort of jumpstart having that sort of organic development again by allowing the older form to be done and then the newer form to be done, and then having people kind of experience both, and then thinking through what to keep and what might be sort of let go, or what newer developments might be brought on. So it's a tricky question, and you want to, you know, as the Catholic Church often does, there's a kind of both and. Should we retain the old? Absolutely. Should we be open to new things in the practical realm? Absolutely. But the process has to go in a kind of orderly form, and a lot of people think that the development of the new form, the Novus Ordo, was one that was done with perhaps not as much care. There's a famous story. So, for instance, you know, Tim, I think you mentioned that your wife just thought the difference was the language, but even the calendar was changed.
Right.
So there's a kind of a different calendar, and many feasts used to have an octave. Now we still have a few things, the octave of Christmas, the octave of Easter, you know, it makes it an 8-day celebration. Pentecost used to have an octave. And the story is told of Pope Paul VI, right, under whose watch the Mass was changed, that at one point, after the change, he was getting ready for Mass, and his sacristan brought out these vestments. And he said, well, where are the Pentecost vestments? It's the octave of Pentecost. And the sacristan said, you know, Your Holiness, there is no more octave of Pentecost. And of course, Pope Paul's realized, oh my goodness.
Yeah, what have I done?
So I think this is a tough issue. How much change and how do you do it? And it's not clear that we've completely gotten there. And like I said, I think this new motu proprio is going to make people lean towards, you know, sort of being set in their ways. Either we've got to go with the new or we've got to go with the old. And I'm not sure that's a completely healthy thing, but it, you know, maybe this is God's way of helping the church make a choice one way or the other too.
Now you had mentioned that you know in some ways this change in the Mass leading to the Novus Ordo didn't happen overnight. There was kind of a build up of a liturgical reform movement leading up to it. What were some of the elements that were being pushed there? I mean, I know there's a massive expansion of the lectionary as part of the Novus Ordo. There's a lot of other changes that people aren't quite necessarily, I think, at least it's not on the top of their minds when they think about the differences between the two Masses. What were some of the things that this liturgical reform movement was advocating?
It started in the 19th century, I'd say, in a French monastery called Salem, and a guy named Dom Prosper Guéranger was active in sort of trying to get back at the church's heritage of chant and the prayers that had sometimes been lost. So at first it was just trying to get back the stuff that had been lost. Then in the early 20th century, this movement, which was primarily, I'd say, in Belgium and Germany and France, a little bit in the United States as well, they were trying to not only recover old things, but also think through ways in which people could actually pray the Mass. And so if you've heard of, you know, Romano Guardini, you know, your favorite German theologian with an Italian name.
Right.
Guardini wrote a little book with the title The Spirit of the Liturgy around 1917, something like that. It really had an effect on Joseph Ratzinger, Pope Benedict, who later wrote his own book with the title The Spirit of the Liturgy. But Guardini had a lot of what the essence of what he thought the movement needed to have was, which was seeing the liturgy as this sort of world we enter into and in which we participate, almost like we go into a game and we play by the rules. And what they were aiming at was that people would really pray the prayers. And that's why there was this movement for vernacular languages, because not everybody could follow the Latin and, you know, the Latin and the translation in their missal quite so easily. But there was also this emphasis on participation, on doing things, not praying the rosary at the same time. Some people took it too far. They'd say, well, it's only in the liturgy, and the liturgy, the hours, should really pray, and they wanted to get rid of the Stations of the Cross and the rosary and things like that. That went, you know, that showed that there was already some people going a little too far. And so what we saw in that movement was some good. Everybody should be praying the liturgy and praying along with the liturgy, that there should be a sort of entering into it and a recovery of older elements. But then there were also some oddities about it. And some people claimed certain things that, well, everybody in the early church celebrated with the priest facing the people. Well, that turned out not to be true. There was a sort of a view that, well, you know, people received communion in the hand because there were a few documents from the 4th century that were attributed to saints that talked about this. Well, that didn't turn out to be universally true either. So there was a lot of mix-up of sort of archaeology and kind of extremism along with some good points. And unfortunately, I think what happened in the 1960s with this is that the good and the bad kind of got mixed up together.
I was wondering, that's a great recounting. I've heard it described too, I had a theology professor describe it too, as, you know, there was a one of the efforts was to reemphasize or make more prominent the meal aspect of the Mass versus the Last Supper, if you will, versus the sacrifice. And so when you make that sort of move and you're committed to that kind of move, that does help explain some of the squirrelier things, I think, that we've maybe all experienced or definitely heard about. And, you know, and that was one of the criticisms I've heard too, that the Novus Ordo is more susceptible to liturgical abuses or missteps because of the way it's structured. But I was wondering too, if you could explain a little, help us understand a little bit about the, we've had the rise of the formation of some religious communities that embrace and are centered on the 1962, Roman rites. So you have, like, for example, the Fraternal Society of St. Peter or Institute of Christ the King. You know,
yeah.
How should we look at those groups? You know, they're in full communion with the Holy Father. The society maybe of Pope Pius X still has some things going on there. But how are we to understand, kind of, because I think most of our experience as the laity is with a diocesan parish, led by a diocesan pastor and pastoral staff. But then there's these pockets of these other things going on. What is all that?
Yeah, well, when one of the things that happened was when Pope Benedict did his motu proprio freeing the Latin Mass, a lot of priests and religious who wanted to sort of serve using those forms decided that they would organize because they wanted, as you said, the Society of St. Pius X, the SSPX as they're known, they were irregular. It was an order that had been formed earlier than the 90s, and their leader was Archbishop Marcel Lefebvre, who was at Vatican II, mm-hmm. and who decided that they needed to protect some of the things that were being lost. And they lost their sort of regular status when Lefebvre decided to consecrate new bishops, and you're not supposed to do that in canon law without the permission of the Pope. And so they've forever been in this kind of legal limbo. It's licit for them to hear confessions and do all that now through measures that are given by Pope Benedict and even Pope Francis. But they're still in an odd situation. So those new orders that sprung up were designed so that people could be fully in communion with the church and enjoy that liturgical heritage. Mm-hmm. And so this is one of the questions with the motu proprio, which seems to indicate that the ultimate goal is to get rid of the old form of the Mass. Well, what about these orders? What's going to happen to them? And the sort of the rationale is that, well, you know, people in these kinds of communities often, cast doubt on whether the new Mass is valid. And I don't think that that's necessarily true. I mean, the Fraternity of St. Peter you mentioned, I think, only does things in the older rites. But the Institute of Christ the King, which has a very church in Chicago, mm-hmm. also does the new form of the Mass in a kind of continuity with the old. So, again, I think that the legal maneuver of Pope Francis is not going to achieve unity, but it's going to sort of break up what was a kind of a healthy relationship and a healthy symbiosis. Those orders are very, very good. We have a fraternity parish in Minneapolis called All Saints, and they've done yeoman's work in terms of keeping things going during the pandemic and serving a number of populations. So I'm grateful to God for them. No doubt there are some crazy ones out there, but Then again, I mean, the Jesuits are mostly crazy these days.
Right, right. Right. I like the word wily for Jesuits. There's a lot of wily. Yeah, there's a few good ones you can point to. Wily. There's a lot of wily ones, though. But we have one, too, here. That's where my wife and I went most recently for the traditional Latin Mass was Fraternal Society of St. Peter's Parish called in Brookville, Indiana, called St. Cecilia and Perpetua, and it was wonderful. You know what's really surprising? I think for a lot of you, if you've not gone to a place that's celebrating the traditional Latin Mass, especially by one of these societies, is the young families, large Catholic families that are young. It's just amazing. And they are just, I mean, it will get, because I'm in my 50s, so I want to know what's going to happen next. You know, what's coming behind me? Kind of legacies coming up. That will encourage you. And it's inspiring. And they're so faithful. And you know what else? They're full of joy. Okay, these are happy people. These are not glum, you know, kind of pining for the past and railing against the new and blah. It's not. That's all urban legend bunk.
Yeah, you know what's funny is there's a little sense of rebelliousness within it. So, in my own family, when the Motu came out, my daughters heard about it. They thought the traditional Latin Mass was going to be completely suppressed. So they and their friends gathered together, and they thought it was this great act of rebellion to go downtown to go to the traditional Latin Mass one morning. And I'm like, you know what?
Over at Holy Rosary.
If that's how you get through your rebellious teenage years, I'm really okay. Right. I'm okay with that. Yeah. You know,
catch your lucky stars. Yeah.
Well, speaking of rebellions and things like that, you had mentioned Archbishop Lefebvre in connection with the traditional Latin Mass, and I think, you know, his name is connected with it to a certain extent, because there's this impression that Vatican II really instituted the change in the Mass. That, you know, I've heard people refer to the Novus Ordo as the Vatican II Mass, or the Mass of Vatican II. That connection isn't quite as concrete as that, is it?
No, not at all. The first document of Vatican II that was finished was called Sacrosanctum Concilium, and it was on the sacred liturgy. And it, you know, it has a number of suggestions, but if you look at it on the face of it, it doesn't necessarily lead to what we have today. And in fact, it has a lot of things about the primacy of Gregorian chant and, you know, the use of Latin, although in certain situations using vernacular could be good. There is a little bit more of the, as one of you mentioned, the emphasis on the meal, and of course, the Eucharist is a meal as well, but it's a sacrificial meal. I think there may be problems with that document, but it doesn't lead directly to the reforms that happened with the 1970 Mass, and so those things were done sort of by a council, a group called the Concilium, that was under the direction of Pope Paul VI. So a lot of people say, well, but you can't challenge anything that the Church has. Well, first of all, you know, church reforms are things that are done by particular people and bishops and popes, and those things are not under the protection of infallibility. So you can say, you know, maybe we went the wrong direction here. Mm-hmm. That's what happens. This was not demanded by Vatican II, but it was a sort of an application. And I think we can say that, you know, perhaps the application wasn't exactly what people wanted. And it wasn't necessarily what ultimately helped. And one of the pieces of evidence is, as you noted, the people who are really attracted to the more traditional forms of liturgy are quite often young, serious Catholics who have no nostalgia for the 1950s because they weren't born until 40 years later.
Right.
And with that, we need to take another break, and we'll be back with more with Dr. David Deva, looking at the Mass, the history, and maybe even the future. You're listening to The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy.
So, the scan button brought you here. Awesome. We like company. Get to know us. And if you have to leave, come back. You're always welcome. Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell, Kent Blanford, and we have with us a special guest today. We have Dr. David Deevil. He's an assistant professor of Catholic Studies at St. Thomas University, University of St. Thomas. Got to get the word order right there, University of St. Thomas.
Beautiful Minneapolis, yes.
Yes, and we are talking about the Mass. We're talking about the traditional Latin Mass, its relationship to the Novus Ordo, the history there, the evolution to a certain extent, if that's what is going on, and possibly the division. So, and we've kind of thrown out both views a little bit here. On the one hand, there, you know, we've talked about how there was a sort of gradual changes within the Mass over time that seemed to speed up a little bit. There was a liturgical reform movement, and then we had the Missal of 1970 that you know, I guess you could say accelerated that overnight to a certain extent. That's one view. The other view is that there's this radical break in continuity, and I've heard that thrown out, the term continuity between the two Masses. Dr. Neville, what would be the argument that there is this sort of discontinuity between the two forms of the Mass?
Well, yeah, I think the biggest argument for the discontinuity might be found, you know, I think I mentioned these statistics of this English scholar Matthew Hazel, that you lose about 87% of the prayers from the old Mass to the new Mass. Now, you do gain some new ones. For instance, in the old rite, there's only one Eucharistic canon, that central part, right, that we call the Eucharistic prayer. In the new rite, there are four sort of ordinary ones. We call them Eucharistic Prayer 1, which is basically a kind of edited version of the old Roman canon. But then there are three others. And then if you look, there are actually probably 5 or 10 more that have been sort of created for different events. And that's one of the things is that is one of the biggest changes itself, is that there are so many options. And so it's, you know, with the older rite, there aren't many options about things to do. There might be, you know, include this or not include it, but there aren't do one of nine Eucharistic prayers. And so I think that's one of the biggest changes, is that there's a kind of almost a free-form quality to the way the newer rite is celebrated, as such that the differences between parish and parish are, you know, can be quite astonishing, and that's even within the legitimate changes. But with having so many choices for what to do, it does give, I think, priests and liturgists the idea that pretty much all of the Mass is malleable. And in fact, some liturgists, have said that, is that, well, under the new rite, what we should think of is these are kind of like, you know, they're kind of like stop signs, for some people. They're suggestions rather than a real rule. And that's what I think is why many people have started to turn towards the older form, is because you know what you're going to get. And you can follow along with it in the book, and you don't have to sort of wonder, now is the priest going to say something completely different from what the prayer is, or do actions that are completely different? So I think that's probably the biggest itself change.
Yeah, one of the criticisms of the Novus Ordo that I often hear is that it puts too much emphasis and puts too much focus on the personality of the priest, right? The priest is supposed to be there in persona Christi, and you know, the criticism is the Novus Ordo really focuses on him, particularly, you know, not only with all the options that you just mentioned, but also with the, you know, with the turning around and facing the congregation rather than being ad orientum, like the traditional Latin Mass says. How valid is that criticism? Is that part of the intention with the Novus Ordo to highlight the priest a little bit, put a little bit more focus on the priest, or is that a valid criticism?
Yeah, no, I think it's a valid criticism, and I mean, one of the see, it's a valid criticism is that when I was in graduate school at Fordham University, you know, over 20 years ago, I was in a course on sacraments and worship with a Jesuit who was, you know, probably not of the farthest left capacity, but he certainly wasn't as traditional as I was.
He was a little wily.
Right.
he was in the middle, you okay. know, but he assigned a book by a feminist theologian at a school in Chicago, and I was reading it, and she started saying, well, you know, at least in the old rite of the Mass, you know, the priest was kind of invisible. He was doing his work, and we were doing our work. And, it, you know, unfortunately, she said, in the newer form, the priest really is at this. So, you know, my rule is, if the feminists are noticing that this is a problem, and, you know, and so are faithful Catholics, this is probably a problem. Professor Michael Foley at Baylor University, great liturgical scholar, scholar of St. Augustine, you know, he's talked about this, about how having the priest turn around, especially when you're focusing on the meal, you know, it can't help but give you that feeling that maybe we're on a cooking show. It's a divine cooking show.
Right, right. The what about this connection? I've heard this connection made, and I'm inclined to kind of to buy into it. So if you look at the some of the statistics about the church, let's just say in the United States, there's a lot of alarming statistics around decline of mass attendance, baptisms, marriages, on and on and on. All the things that we would measure that we'd consider important, just about every number is going the wrong way, and maybe quite a bit. What is often I've heard, you know, that's a product of a lot of things, but one of the main products has been the change in the liturgy. What do you make of that argument?
I think there's some truth to it. I mean, I think one of the biggest changes was, of course, you know, the changes in priests' and bishops' attitudes toward sexual morality. When Humanae Vitae, Pope Paul's document, Exception, came out in 1968, I think a lot of people were ready to sort of throw open the doors to, you know, a kind of a new sexual. The disjunct between that, between the church still officially teaching things, you know, about sexual morality that were biblical and traditional, while many priests and bishops were kind of winking on the ground that, well, that's kind of okay if you do the. I think that's been one of the bigger things. But I think we do have a lot of data that shows that a lot of people were very upset that the older Latin Mass was something that had a draw for people. And in fact, when the newer Mass came about, there was a letter signed by a number of prominent intellectuals in Britain, not all of whom were Catholic. In fact, many of them were non-Catholics, like Agatha Christie, the detective writer, who said, "Don't get rid of this. This is a part of, you know, this is a part of our cultural heritage. This is a part of history, and it's a thing that is beautiful," which, as the poet Keats said, is a joy forever. You know, don't right. get rid of this.
Right.
So I can't help but think that it had something to do with it. David Bentley Hart, who's an Eastern Orthodox theologian, wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal about 10 years ago. And said, well, you know, people still have this sort of almost aesthetic conversion in the Orthodox Church, where they see the beauty and the glory of the Lord. And he said, you know, you don't see that as much in Catholic areas anymore. And I think he's right, and I think that's a sad thing, because the Lord works through truth, goodness, and beauty, and a beauty in the liturgy especially.
Well, and I've noticed, too, because a really profound similarities between the traditional Latin Mass, that liturgy, with the Byzantine liturgy, that one, you know, being in communion, another rite of the Catholic Church, but then also with there's a local Syrian Orthodox Church, and when you look at those three, you see a lot more in common with those three liturgies than you do with, say, the Novus Ordo, with any one of those other three. So it seemed, because I think they're more ancient. So they're all in some sense sharing in the ancient patrimony that's been handed down. And that would, to me, lend itself to that argument that this may be more, have elements of rupture versus continuity. I know we only have a handful of minutes left. I do want to ask, I'll bring up once again, you're a contributor to this new book, From Benedict's Peace to Francis's War, which is the subtitle here is Catholics Respond to the Motu Proprio Traditionis Custodes. Tell us a little bit, Dr. Deevil, what are we going to find in that book when Mark buys it for us for Christmas?
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, as the editor, Peter Kwasniewski, says, it's not a sort of a, this isn't the kind of the fair and balanced take. This is mostly people who are identifying problems with this and defending the use of, you know, even the superiority in some cases of the older form of mass. I'm like you guys. I mean, I don't go to the extraordinary form or the traditional Latin mass parish all the time. I like to go to it when I can. My regular parish is, is Novus Ordo Parish. But I see the value in it. There are a number of contributors like me in there, but there are also a number of them who really love this. Love this older form of the mass, and it includes a number of distinguished contributors who made responses to this, including Cardinal Leo Raymond Burke, Cardinal Mueller, who used to work for the Congregation of the Holy Faith, Cardinal Seurat, the Guinean bishop, who is such an incredible writer. But then there are some people like Ross Douthat at the New York Times, philosopher Edward Faser, Catholic journalist Phil Lawler, Joseph Shaw, who's at the head of the Latin Mass Society in the United Kingdom. So there's a whole ton of these contributors from different points of view in many ways, but all sort of trying to defend tradition and defend the possibility that we can keep the goods of the past and make them work in the future.
So, well, you just ticked off an all-star list, so Mark and I are here smiling when you see who's in there. So we definitely got to get that. I mean, those are people really.
I was
going to
say a lot of former guests on our show.
Yeah, that's true too. Yeah. So we, you're up to a lot of stuff. What's one of the ways, Dr. Devo, or best ways, really kind of follow your work and the things that you're up to? How do we get a hold of Logos Magazine? And magazine's the wrong word. It's a periodical. I mean, I get Time Magazine just to see what that part of the culture is up to. It's not that. It's completely fantastic. It's a whole different thing, Logos. But tell us a little bit about that and how we keep up with you.
Yeah, so I'm on LinkedIn. I'm not on a lot of the social media these days. I found that it distracted me from getting a lot of work done. But I'm on LinkedIn, and you can find me at the University of St. Thomas. Send me an email. stthomas.edu is the address of the university. And you can just search for Logos, a Journal of Catholic Thought and Culture. Our web address is too long, unfortunately, to read.
Oh, sure.
But send me an email. Get a hold of Logos. You can take a look at our new initiative. We have a podcast that you can find on SoundCloud or Stitcher or Google Play or Apple, and it's called Deep Down Things, in which we interview a lot of the people who've been writing for our journal. So take a look at any of those, and like I said, send me an email or contact me on LinkedIn.
Well, that's fantastic, and we want to thank you for coming back into the Catholic Cave and talking about this. You know, you've done so much scholarly work, not only on this topic, but also, again, if you're listening, you want to learn more about Solzhenitsyn, John Henry Newman, Chesterton, you got to look up the work that Dr. Deville's been doing with those individuals, those figures. And hey, also tell us, I got a quick second here. You're going on you're hosting a trip overseas. Yes. Tell us about that. That sounds fabulous.
Yeah, so Father Dwight Longenecker, you may have had him on the show as well, but he is a priest in South Carolina, very prolific writer in the public sphere, has written a number of books. He and I are going to be leading a pilgrimage to England to look at the English martyrs and also the famous English Catholic literary figures, and we're pretty Catholic small c about that. We'll talk a little bit about C.S. Lewis and other people. That trip you can find out about through our organization called Select International Tours, English Martyrs and Catholic Literary Heroes, a pilgrimage to England, and that will be at the end of May and the beginning of June 2022.
All right, that's a little something to look forward to, just like we hope you'll look forward to the next episode of The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy. Until next time, for Mark Tuttle, For Timothy O'Donnell, for Dr. David Deville, I'm Kent Blanford. Pray for us. We'll pray for you. God bless.
The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at catholicradioindy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to kent@catholicradioindy.org or by calling 317-870-8400.
Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at catholicradioindy.org.
You can hear the Holy Mass every day at 8 a.m. right here on Catholic Radio Indy.